Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we are here with
Chris Ginnaba
and
Rachel Zampelli.
And we are here talking Arthur Miller's The Crucible, Total Witch Hunt, which is now at Olney Theater Center now through May 20th. Thanks so much for coming in, guys.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Yeah, I've been seeing the ad. We might as well start there. I've been seeing the ads everywhere saying Total Witch Hunt. I mean, I got to say, that's pretty genius for you guys to clasp onto that.
Yeah, it was sort of fortuitous that this play came along. Obviously, it came along for a certain reason. They wanted to do it for this time. But the fact that we have a president that likes to use that phrase certainly works out.
And likes to tweet.
Yeah,
fortunate for us.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like free promotion.
Mm-hmm, indeed.
Now, obviously, the Crucible goes back. I mean, I'm sure we all read it back in probably middle school, high school, something. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you're talking about how one president's using it in one way, but this it has deep political backstory to it, right? Because I'm pretty sure Arthur Miller wrote it as sort of an allegory to what he was going through with McCarthyism, right? Talk to that a little bit, and how I believe he was even called in front of the House on American.
He was. He was one of the people that were called and accused of being a communist. He had to answer to the House of Un-American Activities Commission during the McCarthy era.
Isn't one of your lines based on what he actually said?
Which one, actually?
I cannot judge another.
Yeah, which is, you know, one of the lines that Proctor utters is, I speak my own sins. I cannot judge another. I have no tongue for it, which is something very akin to what Arthur Miller said in front of the commission. He didn't believe in the idea of naming somebody else or talking about somebody else, only talking about what he has done and how he lived his life. And obviously, you know, as you mentioned, the idea that this is a parable from the McCarthy era, which was a time of paranoia, a time of accusations, and in an attempt to discredit people or ruin them for other people's own gain, is something that Arthur Miller was very much against. And the parable holds very much true today. I mean, it works in this era just as much as it did, you know, 60, 70 years ago. God, is it 60, 70? It is, right?
53, I think the play was. Is it 53?
Right?
Mm-hmm. Something like
that. I think you won the turn in 53. Yeah, so, I mean... We were just talking about this the other day in a talk back, how these episodes seem to crop up in American society over and over again. And that's kind of funny. I mean, when, you know, history's doomed to repeat itself if you forget it. And obviously, it seems like the American public finds themselves forgetting history more often than not. Yeah. I don't know what that speaks to. Maybe a lack of education or a lack of people's apathy. I don't really know.
But at least it'll make the play relevant for
it. It does.
Decades
That's
from now, we'll still be
That's
watching
true.
It.
Which speaks to how great the play is itself.
Yeah.
Though,
well, let's get into that a little bit. We kind of talked about what you know it is an allegory for, but talk about how that manifests itself in the play with the Salem witch trials. Let's do a little plot summary, I guess, to remind us if we haven't read it since I.
Yeah, indeed.
So yes, the play takes place in Salem, Massachusetts, and basically finds them. The town right before everything blows up. Some hysteria starts. Some children start some hysteria. They get caught dancing in the woods, and to cover their own butts, they start pointing fingers, and everyone starts pointing at each other, and everyone has to keep doubling down on their lies and their suspicions. Hashtag fake news is everywhere, and it escalates very quickly and becomes life or death very quickly.
Yeah, and people start using ulterior motives. Like Abby has an ulterior motive. Reverend Paris has an ulterior motive. The Putnams have an ulterior motive. Everybody has an ulterior motive of why they start accusing other people for these reasons.
This is all in just Arthur Miller's first act, which is half of our first act. And then the second act finds us in the Proctor house, and you meet Elizabeth and you find out sort of what's going on in their lives. And then the hysteria and everything just encroaches on their house and their lives. And that's how the first act ends. Mm-hmm. And then the second act is kind of what the town ends up doing and the choices people end up making. And well, you'll have to buy your tickets to see what happens, or just go to Wikipedia. It's fine.
Yeah.
You definitely see the McCarthyistic character come forth, or I mean, I guess a comparable character today would be for my money and my opinion, almost anybody in the Trump organization that decries something that they don't like opinion-wise. You see the McCarthyistic character in Danforth. He appears in our quote-unquote second act.
He's the deputy governor of the province.
And you see his accusations and you see him sort of press for the truth that he wants to hear and not what the actual truth is.
Right, right. Sort of bending the truth into...
Exactly.
Alternative facts.
Alternative facts is absolutely.
You mentioned hashtag fake news is everywhere. Is it? Do you actually play that up on stage, or you just mean like metaphorically or symbolically? It is.
I mean, it's not on.
Right.
You know, but it's.
It's still a traditional presentation of the Crucible, right?
No. Okay, yes, absolutely.
I gotcha.
Traditional in that there's no added anything, but I mean, literally one of the first. You know, things that happens is Ann Putnam comes in and she says, "How high did she fly?"
Mm-hmm.
And she's saying, "Oh, we heard." No, she did. She flew over
Ingersoll's
barn. Yeah. So and so told me, and everybody thinks it's there's fake news all over. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, and people will recognize that.
Yes, you know, just absolutely.
Lies beget lies, you know. Right. As it starts to fly forward, as I said with Danforth, you believe the truth that you want to believe, regardless of the facts that are presented to you.
Yeah.
You know, all of a sudden, facts aren't facts anymore because they're not the facts that you want to believe.
Right, right.
Yeah, that's definitely in it. But speaking to that, there are anachronistic elements to this play, especially when it comes to the set. You know. But that's it, and that the set has anachronisms in it merely because we want people to see that this actually does update to our time.
Explain.
It starts.
Paint that visually. So since we're radio, I mean, I like this idea, but tell me kind of what.
Sort of starts in in Reverend Paris's house. You have there's a bed that's anachronistic. It's made of steel and instead of wood, things like that. In the Proctor house, there's a stove, an actual stove, a metal stove that never would have existed in our time. I feel like there might be something else too.
There's the
in our. Is there something else in our house?
Not really, except for the slats that are missing.
Maybe the spoon. I'm using the spoon.
Your
spoon is,
as opposed to being
heavy
wood,
metal. And so then as the play goes on, especially in the second act, when everything starts going out in the court and Danforth comes on and there are fluorescent lights that come down, as well as in the prison, and everything sort of there are these jagged red planks of wood that form the woods at all times, and very much so in the first act and in the prologue with the girls. But the red planks literally start encroaching on our space. They start jutting into the actual proscenium area of the stage as you go along.
So does the visual presentation evolve from the more traditional towards the anachronistic as it goes on? Or?
For me, the idea when I look at it, it starts off as a world that you kind of don't recognize, and then by the end of it, it's like, oh wait, this is now, this is here.
It
starts looking more and more like our world.
Except for the costumes. The costumes end up being very traditional. But yeah, it's very light touch in that way.
Describe the costumes, because I have a very vivid, you think of the Daniel Day-Lewis movie and everything.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Very much like that. Yeah. Go ahead.
As the Crucible goes, they did incorporate, they are not traditional as it usually is. There are colors on stage. Elizabeth has a green dress.
There are colors,
the design of it is really beautiful. It's made off this. It's called a Celine. I lucked out. I get to look way probably prettier than Elizabeth Proctor ever gets to look. And they put the girls in prints and things like that. But it never goes farther than that's from the beginning. Though she incorporates our modern into this sort of 1600s from the get-go. It never escalates. It's
everything looks very period from a shape perspective, but I think you're right. From a color perspective, there's a little more, there's a wider palette. In Puritanical society, they were pretty much black and white. There was no, I think color represented pleasure, just like dancing did, all these kind of things that Puritans would not allow themselves to be a part of. But,
gotcha.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it can still work with color. I mean, Handmaid's Tale with the red, and that's very
actually,
puritanical.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, very much like that.
Awesome. So. Tell me about you guys, your characters. I mean, I know you gave the plot summary, but go into. I mean, it's John Proctor and Elizabeth Proctor, right?
Yep.
What's sort of where you guys find yourself when the play starts, and what's sort of your character arc throughout?
So when the play starts, there's already some trouble that has occurred, but we don't know that yet until John Proctor enters. You kind of hear it a little bit as the play starts between Reverend Paris and Abby. There's a scene, and Reverend Paris is sitting on the bed of his daughter, Betty, mm-hmm. who is for some reason sleeping, and then he starts questioning Abigail and what her status is in the town. And then you see Proctor show up, and you realize that they've had a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
and then, basically, John Proctor is this very, very, I think he considers himself an upright, good Christian man who doesn't actually believe in this sort of hellfire and damnation of the Bible, but believes in sort of the do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Right, right.
Version of the Bible, that kind of golden rule that I,
sure.
And I personally, as Chris, believe that that's the most important takeaway from any sort of any right. spiritual teaching. And I think Proctor pretty much feels the same way. So but he's living with this sin that he's committed. So he's a tortured soul. And he kind of attempts to fix that throughout the show. I mean, the first act is sort of him trying to repair the relationship with Elizabeth, live in a more upstanding way. And then in the second act, you see sort of the dissolution of his belief in humanity and certainly in God. And then he comes back to attempting to recover his own goodness. And he finds that through Elizabeth.
Oh, and what would be your journey, you think, from start to finish? Where do you end up character arc wise compared to where you start, you think?
She's fantastic because it's you couldn't ask for a better arc. So yeah, when we first sort of look into their relationship, it's not going well. There's been infidelity, and it's been 7 months.
Mm-hmm.
And it's obvious that things aren't going well. These people and Elizabeth are not people who are used to communication about feelings and about things, and people don't talk about I was gonna say it's not like it is now, but plenty
time,
of people not functioning all the time.
Yeah.
There was no therapy. They're not going to couples therapy. They're not talking about it to their friends. When we meet her, she's dealing with all of these feelings that she's never had to deal with in her life. On top of the fact that her husband cheated on her with a 17-year-old in a barn.
How dare you, sir.
In a barn.
Where my beasts are bedded.
The girl who she dismissed for, sleeping with her husband is now going around accusing people of
right.
being a witch, and she knows she's at the top of her list.
Yeah.
As far as, John being an upright Christian and Elizabeth absolutely is an upright Christian, and she prides herself on that. Mm. And I think sort of what she's going through a lot in the first scene and as she in where her journey goes is that part of being an upright Christian is not judging another and is about forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And I don't think she's ever had to prove that to anybody.
Yeah.
And so you're faced with, and this happens to a lot of us who've ever experienced anything like this in our marriages or our relationships, that you say, I don't judge another. And then you do, when it actually is hard to not judge them. I can forgive, and you can't. It's hard. And so you have to work on it. So she's having to deal with this stuff that she's never had to deal with in her life. And it all happens like, bam.
And one of the main cruxes of what ends up happening to them is actually because Elizabeth and Proctor says this, John Proctor says this at one point, is that she's a woman that cannot lie. And the world knows she cannot. And he says it several times. He says it also to Danforth in the third scene, that my wife will never lie. There are them that cannot sing and them that cannot weep. Mm-hmm. My wife cannot lie. Is that she ends up, in order to protect mm-hmm. John Proctor and their relationship and to try to save him as an upright man, she lies.
Yeah.
And that's
sort of the beautiful irony.
Yeah, yeah. The irony is thick.
And it's this great point for them too, because it's kind of it's a lot of things, but it's putting him before herself. It's like saying, I forgive you.
All in that moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the cool thing about, I think, John and Elizabeth is Chris and I joke not really, but kind of, about hashtag Team Proctor. And there, and but I like what it says about love and people who make a family together in marriage and all of that, because they do start out very separate. And the thing is, as soon as something comes in that's threatening their family, mm-hmm. they are a team. And I love how they come together.
I agree.
It's weird talking about this, actually, because it's stuff that you don't talk about to right. the other person all that's the time. True. But huge. And that happens. Sometimes you can be at each other. You know, I know with me and my husband, but if somebody were to come in and try to come at me, he would do exactly what John Proctor said.
Right,
no,
right.
no, that's my wife. And as far as when the girl he slept with and maybe thought he loved, or that's your business, you know, comes in and starts threatening me, he's like, no, don't mess with my family.
Right.
And to
right.
speak to that, that's why the play is actually still brilliant and relevant, because mm-hmm. while in Puritanical society, these people might not have talked to each other openly, they're actually very modern characters. They're mm-hmm. they're characters we can very much identify with, mm-hmm. Including, I mean, I think there's some real modern sensibilities, even like psychologically speaking. You know, we talked about this laughing about the word quail. Mm-hmm. At one point, when all goes wrong at the end of that court scene, and Abigail has turned the tables on everybody by seeing spirits and all this stuff, and Danforth has completely bought what happened, and Elizabeth has lied, and therefore nothing that the Proctors say is true anymore. Mm-hmm. So now John Proctor is damned. He finally says that God is dead. Now, whether you believe that or not is irrelevant. That's fine. But he says, I've seen the boot of Lucifer. I've heard the. I did it. I have heard the boot of Lucifer. I have seen his filthy face, and it is my face and yours, Danforth. For them that quail to bring men out of ignorance, as I have quailed, and as you quail now, when you know in all your black hearts that this be false. You know, it's again that kind of speaking to fake news. You know, if you who said recently that it wasn't the journalist's job to say that the president or that Sarah Sanders was lying, which is just absurd.
Yeah. Mm.
Because if it's not the journalist's job to do it, to hold, whose is it? I mean, certainly the American public are beholden from an information standpoint to the journalists. Mm. And that's what I think Proctor is saying at that point. I mean, if we quail to bring men out of ignorance, we are damned. Whether God exists or no, that's the most important thing in the world. It is the truth, not alternative facts. I mean, it's incumbent upon both the journalists and the people to do their due diligence in finding out what the truth is. Mm. So that's a modern sense. It's a sort of a modern, I mean, it's not a modern philosophy. It's a human philosophy. I mean, right. It should be, at least. Right?
Timeless human philosophy.
It
should be.
I agree. Yeah, it should be. So.
Well, I'm jacked to see it. Tell me about you guys. Tell me about you guys. Just a little back. I always like to see, you know, how you got into acting and that sort of thing.
Right.
So,
after you.
From
where'd you grow up?
From the beginning?
We're going to have to do a condensed version because we've already gone like a half hour. But
I grew up in PG County in Bowie, Maryland.
Nice.
And I did community theater, summer theater, anything but professional theater. My parents weren't too keen on that. Yeah. And then I went to college at Santa Clara University for theater acting, and then started working professionally after college.
And we've seen you at Olney Theater before?
Yes. This is my fifth show. Yeah. Avenue Q.
Annie.
This is my first play at Olney.
Okay. So all musicals.
Yes. Avenue Q. Evita, Avenue Q, Sweeney Todd, yeah.
The list goes on and on.
And something, yeah.
You do Godspell?
Godspell.
There you go.
Yes. Good. Good.
And we've definitely seen you there before.
Yes, I've been there. This is my fourth show, actually. But I'm from Decatur, Georgia, originally, and then... And then I was in Chicago for a long time, and both my parents were involved in acting at one point. And my grandparents were, both sets were involved in some kind of theatrical art. Mm-hmm. So I kind of grew up with it and went to school in Chicago, and then I've been here since 2009. And let's see, I did Awaken Sing.
My Fair Lady?
My Fair Lady at Carousel. And then, now this. Olney's is just a fantastic place to work, so I'm glad to keep having me back.
Fun fact, this is our second show together.
It is,
Whoa. Yeah. We only did one other show together it was like
8 years ago.
Pretty much the beginning of my career, and I don't know how far you were.
What was the show and where?
It was Orestes, a tragic romp by Anne Washburn.
Oh.
At Folger Shakespeare.
At Folger, yeah.
Directed by Aaron Posner, and it was an 8-person.
It was
epic.
It was it was. I think even Anne said this that. The title isn't quite representative of the adaptation that she wrote. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's a wonderful title, but mm-hmm. it was a traditional Greek, but updated, where only three people played all of the characters.
Oh, cool!
And then five of us.
And
were,
then five
there was
were the
a
chorus.
Five-woman Greek chorus.
But
that
modern music
sang
done by James Sugg.
Weird. Right? And he played Helen of Troy at one point.
Oh god! Yeah.
And he looked like
nope. I could see that.
And he looked like Marlon Brando in The Island of Dr. Moreau.
But I also played Menelaus, a Trojan, and
mostly women
and Pylades.
He mostly wore heels.
I don't care if Helen of Troy walks in.
I did have to, but I had to like. You know what? Funny, fun fact. Speaking to that, is that we went up to Red Bank, New Jersey, with that show, and I got one of the funniest reviews I think I've ever read in my life from the New Jersey Star Ledger. This guy wrote. He goes, and Ginnaba, who plays Helen of Troy at one point, doesn't have a face that would launch a single ship, let alone 1,000 ships.
You'll never forget that one.
That's so true.
I was like, oh.
As a woman, as a man, you are.
It's so good.
This one.
Yeah.
No, it was pretty hilarious. It's one of those things where you can only laugh at it.
That's great.
Yeah,
that's
it was great. It was great. Because it is true. You're right.
Oh, absolutely. Well, they won't be saying that about this play.
That's right.
In closing, you know, our listeners have heard this. Of course, they're familiar with The Crucible, but, you know, it's important. I think it's important to keep revisiting these. And it reminds you, like, just why powerful and why they were a big deal to begin with. But just why should our listeners come out? It's a simple question.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a good play. It's nice when you know you're in a good play.
Mm-hmm.
My husband can't wait to come back. That is all I have to say. And if Mercer Jackson wants to come back to sit through an entire play, that means he was crying. He said everybody's great in it. We have actors coming to see it that are so invested, judgy actors, you know, who come and honestly say afterwards, this is a really good play. Mm-hmm. It's really well done.
It is a good play. And that's, I think, the most important thing is that the play itself is great. I also think that our production happens to move, even though it does clock in at just under 3 hours.
Yeah, it's an epic crucible for an actor to go through, too.
You know, and Arthur Miller calls it Act 1, Act 2, Act 3, Act 4. He doesn't call them scenes. Okay. And the reason why is because it's operatic in scope. Right. Every act has its own movement. And I think it moves rather quickly. It moves quick.
It does.
Is there an intermission between each of the four or just one?
No, just one. It's 3 hours with intermission. Gotcha. Yeah. So that's full.
But just to tell a great little story, there's a guy named Will Love, who's an actor in Baltimore right now, but I think a long time ago he was an arena theater company member. He tells this story about how he was in Death of a Salesman with Hal Holbrook playing Willie Loman, and that Arthur Miller came to see that production.
Oh, wow.
And they were so excited that he was there, and they wanted to speak to him afterwards, but he didn't talk to anyone. He just went out to dinner with Hal Holbrook, and Hal Holbrook said, "Don't worry, I'll get the lowdown. I'll tell you how he thought about it, blah, 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 blah." And apparently they went to dinner, and the only thing he said was, "Well, I've written a really good play." And that's,
it's a compliment, I guess, but
who knows what we actually thought of the production, but the fact of the matter is it's a great play.
Yeah.
The Crucible is a great play.
Yeah.
I think it's as good as Death of the Salesman. It's as good as any play that he has written. And that's sort of, I just want to tell that story because it actually reminds me of what the play is.
The characters are fantastic. Their journeys are fantastic.
Yeah.
It's all the reasons, and what Eleanor Holdridge, her vision is clear and different. But not to be different. It is not your.
It's not going out of its
it
way.
It is not necessary.
You know,
no,
that's
it's
a
not.
Really good point. Eleanor Holdridge did an amazing job with this, and she really wanted to promote the idea of the women in the play,
mm-hmm.
And how they interact in this sort of patriarchal, puritanical world.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you can speak.
Kelly Dunbar's their choreographed movement into it, which I have never seen in a crucible. All of the transitions.
Oh yeah, they're wicked.
Have movement. Even John Proctor isn't doing movement at the beginning of the show. I've never seen that done. I've never seen.
There's a lot more blocking and choreography than maybe past productions.
There is. It's, yeah, there's no doubt.
Yeah, it's not all literal.
I mean, yeah, it's not Ivo van Ho or anything. Right. I don't know. It's different. It's yeah,
it's a really cool production, a really wonderful, honest production.
Agreed.
Awesome. Well, everyone, come out to Olney Theater Center to check out Arthur Miller's The Crucible, which is a really good play, as you said. now through May 20th. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Man.